Did you have some direct dealings with Gene Kirkpatrick and Haig?
Haig, oh sure. Yeah, I met all, yeah. He was a bit of the wall. I mean, Haig really something. Really. I remember I met him in St. Lucia in this much publicized encounter between him and I. By all America, there were all the ABC, CBS, NBC. They had two crews, one to cover him and one to cover me. And the whole thing that they covered about the OAS meeting in St. Lucia, in the Caribbean country, was this. It, I remember well when I first saw him. So I came to sit in that great big table where the ministers sit, and it was across from me. He kept trying to intimidate me by eyeing me down, do you say, by giving me this great...
Eyeballing
you. I said, what's wrong with you? Are you nuts? Any revolution, if it's an authentic revolution, in ours was, at the core of our purpose is the people's power, democratization. And that implies automatically the development of respect for human rights, political, civil, economic, cultural, and social. I'm sorry to say, but it's so evident that lying and deceit, systematic lying and deceit, are the main tools of U.S. foreign policy. Mm-hmm. They lie to, that's why I worry so much about American democracy.
Miguel Descoto went from being a Mary Knoll priest to being foreign minister of Sandinista Nicaragua. We talk with him right now on Alternative Views.
We're extremely pleased to have with us today Father Miguel Descoto, who was the Minister of Foreign Affairs for the Nicaraguan government during the Sandinista regime. Father Descoto was born in California in 1933 to Nicaraguan parents and returned to live in Nicaragua at the age of one. He attended secondary school in Nicaragua, but then returned to the United States for his undergraduate studies. He earned his B.A. in 1956 at Mary Knoll College and his M.A. in religious education at the Mary Knoll Seminar in New York, and was ordained a Mary Knoll priest in June of 1961. In 1962, he received an M.S. in comparative journalism from Columbia University's Pulitzer School of Journalism. In 1962, Father Descoto went to Cuba, to Chile, where he founded the Institute for Neighborhood Action and Research in Santiago and served there for some years. Father Descoto also became involved with the Sandinista Front for the National Liberation of Nicaragua in the late 1970s. In 1977, he helped form the group of 12 that composed of professionals and intellectuals who supported the liberation movement in Nicaragua. After the victory of the Sandinista Front in July of 1979, he was appointed to serve the newly formed government as the foreign minister of Nicaragua and held that position until after the 1990 elections. So we're extremely pleased to have you with us today, Miguel. Thank you for coming.
Thank you for inviting us.
What we want to do is to kind of provide you with a historical perspective on Nicaragua and the Sandinista Revolution, what they accomplished, and what has happened since then.
Father Miguel, can you give us a bit more information on
the origin of the Sandinistas, the fact that it was particularly what, not particular organization, but a front. They called it a front. What does that mean?
You know, it's not really a front in the usual sense of... A front means several organizations that merge and come together. The Frente Sandinista, in that sense, although we called it a front because we imitated the name from Algiers, from the National Liberation Front of Algiers.
Right.
And we copied, we were inspired, our young people, and they copied that name, but to make it Nicaraguan. And since we were inspired on the thought of Sandino, we call it Sandinista National Liberation Front, but it's not a front in the sense that it is not a collection of several groups that merged. It was one from the very beginning. It was inspired in the action of Sandino. Sandino was a patriot who back in the late 20s fought for the expulsion of the Marines from Nicaragua. Nicaragua had been occupied by the United States practically since 1910, when they overthrew the president and then began sent Marines to Nicaragua to hold the people down as they were protesting because they wanted to determine their own destiny. And so at any rate Sandino fought for that, and in 1933, on the 1st of January, the Marines left, and they had left behind them the National Guard, an organization that they had founded after the model of what they had already done in the Dominican Republic 10 years before. And many American observers were saying, don't do that in Nicaragua because you will... This fellow that you're appointing to be the head of the National Guard is going to become a second Trujillo. And that's exactly what happened.
Somoza.
The first heads of the Nicaragua National Guard were American generals. And then when they left, they appointed Somoza. And one of his first tasks was to get rid of Sandino. Sandino had retired to the mountains in northern Nicaragua. He had established this farmers' cooperatives in Wiwili. It's a mountain town, 300 families. He had been invited to come down to the presidential palace in Managua for a banquet in his honor. After the banquet, as he was coming down that hill, he was ambushed and taken away and shot. And then they went to the house of the Minister of Agriculture, Sofonía Salvatierra, who was his host. That's where Sandino was staying overnight with the other people who came with him. And they killed everyone else who was there too. And then they went to Wiwili, and they wiped off, killed all of the people who belonged to the cooperative, hoping in that manner to erase forever this nationalistic spirit and this fight for sovereignty and independence and among our people. But then, you know, as they said in the early church, the blood of martyr is the seed of converts. So we saw sprouting all over the place los cachorros, as we say, the cubs of Sandino. And the Frente Sandinista was formed again in 1960. And it grew and grew and grew until the man who was to become the president of Nicaragua, Daniel Ortega, was freed from prison in 1974. And he led our country, first of all, to plan for the final insurrection. He was only 28. He had been in jail that last period for 7 years. He had initially gone to jail the first time when he was 14. He's a Catholic, a devout Catholic, and he said that he could not be faithful to Christ when he was 14 if he watched with folded arms what was happening to the people. And he became involved. He became engaged in activities against the Somoza dynastic dictatorship.
Which was horribly brutal by any standards.
What attracted you initially to join the Sandinistas, and what were some of your first experiences with the movement?
Well, first of all, let me divide it into parts. What attracted me to Sandino? You must know, first of all, that in Nicaragua it was virtually impossible to get any documentation, any books on Sandino. Nicaragua may be, well, the only country in all of Latin America, or maybe the world as far as I know, where you don't have sources, historical sources, at the National Library on your own country. One of the methods that Somoza used to, in his process of domestication, it was to make sure that people did not have pride in their own identity or even had a sense of their own identity. And so, but I began at age 12 collecting books. At age 13, I left my country for 36 years. And all over the world, I looked for books. Today, I have the most complete library on Nicaragua matters. I learned that way about Sandino. Sandino became known to the world, to Latin America, through a great man from Argentina who died only recently in Mexico, Gregorio Seltzer. He wrote several books on Sandino. And what attracted me to Sandino is that I found it very attractive that he loved the American people in spite of the fact that our country was victimized by the American government. And I found that extremely appealing. This man who really didn't have that much education, he knew how to read, and he was sophisticated enough to make a distinction between the official policy of a government and a people. And his brother Socrates Sandino was sent on several occasions to the States by General Sandino to speak before solidarity groups. There were many here in Philadelphia, was a great big one, in Chicago, in New York, in Brooklyn, down, not in Miami. Miami wasn't much of anything then, but in Los Angeles and like that. And so that attracted me to Sandino. But, and of course the cause. But I never knew that I knew anyone who was a member of the Frente Sandinista. Remember, I didn't live in Nicaragua.
Right. You were in the
I was a missionary in Chile, mm-hmm. and then in the States. I was director of communications for Marinol in New York. And as far as I knew, when I wrote the introduction to the history of the National Guard of Nicaragua, I do mention the Frente Sandinista, but when I wrote that, I never knew that I knew anyone who was a member. Mm. Because people didn't come up to you and say, hi, I'm a member. That was a clandestine organization. Then I was called.
And when was by this?
By
what
then
year
was it? I was called in 75.
75.
And I, you know, I had to go. And first I said, look, I don't know if I can. I admire you for what you're doing, but I'm committed to nonviolence. Not that I want to deprive anyone or any people of the right to use any means to save their life. Because of the church's negligence, we never really took an element of the gospel seriously, which is the spirituality of struggle, of nonviolent struggle. And we therefore allow the cancer of injustice to grow to such dimensions that it makes it inevitable that eventually you have a big problem. I had been influenced very much in the United States by Dr. Martin Luther King, the greatest influence in my life of any contemporary. Later on, through King, I went to Gandhi. So it's from Christ to King to Gandhi. But they told me, well, Father, we know exactly. They had well documented everything that I had said and written. And say, but we want this ingredient. He says, we are not militarist and we are not violent, but we're going to fight. And we want you to help us to help us to establish the direction in which we must go to really create an authentic democracy. You know, that word, so dirtied by the likes of Reagan or Bush, the Pharisees of Western democracy, it's a good word. And we have been working to rescue it, because it means empowerment of the people. It means people through. It's not only politically what I would call a political expediency, this is a moral, religious imperative to work so that the people have the reins of their own destiny. And so they asked me to help them and to work with them, so I said, I'll probably get in trouble with the church, but I don't want to get in trouble with our Lord on that day of reckoning, so I accept. I will not walk onto Jericho and lead you bleeding by the roadside. And so I got involved, and then it grew, and then Daniel said, now you must be my foreign minister. I said, Daniel, please let me go to the slums where I have always worked.
Now, excuse me, was this after they had kicked Somoza out, or were they still fighting in the jungle, in the mountains?
No, when I was brought in first, is when we were fighting. Right. Before the insurrection, before the final, right. I was brought in as a member of the Frente. But then, when Somoza was still there, remember we named the junta, a government, although he's still there, and then Daniel named me foreign minister.
Before the revolution even carried through.
Before Somoza went out.
Right.
And as such, I spoke at the Organization of American States in that historic 17th consultative meeting,
right.
Where the United States had, in the last moment when they realized that the Sandinistas were going to overthrow Somoza, they wanted to have a green light for American intervention. And the way they do that is they get an approval for the sending of an inter-American peacekeeping force, which is really an American invasion with a little camouflage of some token representation from other countries, as they had done in the Dominican Republic.
Right, exactly.
And, well, with the help of God, we managed to obtain the greatest defeat ever for the United States at what had been, to then, the Ministry of Colonies, the OAS. Hmm. That was the turning point.
Right. Where were you on the eve of the revolution? Were you still in the United States, or had you returned to Nicaragua?
On the eve of the overthrow of Somoza?
Yes, exactly.
I was, totally involved. I was already acting as the foreign minister of the Sandinista National Liberation Front.
Were you living in Nicaragua, or you were still?
No, I had 30 years prison sentence in Nicaragua, so I lived in Nicaragua, but I was one night here, two nights there.
Underground.
I was a member of the Group of 12, you remember, and we got this. So, but I was all over. I never stopped traveling.
So what was it like, Somoza left, and suddenly you are the foreign minister? What were the feelings and the experiences of the early days?
And what was it like? Suddenly, heavens, you're the foreign minister of a new government, a liberated country, and you yourself now are foreign minister and have to deal with the foreign ministers of other countries, particularly a lot of those that had oppressed your people.
Yeah. I never was so much like thinking, you know, like I'm the foreign minister. I'm thinking the people are suffering there. And this is what we have to fight for in this meeting, and this is the objectives here and that, and we were quite successful, and the United States tried to pin four against one, and then they came to the conclusion that the reason why the four couldn't trap us is because, as Secretary of State Haig said, Central American foreign ministers are superstitious. They're Catholics and superstitious, and they don't want to come on full force against a foreign minister who happens to be a priest.
Right.
And Kirkpatrick said it was most unfair of the Sandinistas to put a priest because that somehow inhibited the other people from. And they even sent messages, one message through the Mexicans to tell us that the relations would be better if they changed, they took me out. And I was there when Daniel got the message. And the Mexicans said, look, we are not messengers of you. But they told us.
Right.
Says, you tell them, you find someone else. But they did tell us.
did you have some direct dealings with Jean Kirkpatrick and Haig and some of the thugs?
You remember I had those two debates with Jean Kirkpatrick, right, on television. And she said, after the first one, she said she'd never do it again, and she was at a disadvantage.
Right. That was on Nightline, wasn't it?
And then on Nightline,
I remember
seeing. Then Ted said, well, he'll never get us together again. But he did, because the second time, he got out of it by saying that I was in Buenos Aires, and that she was in Washington or in New York or something. But anyways, we did that second one. And who else did you ask whether I met Haig? Oh, sure. Yeah, I met, he was a bit of the wall. I mean, Haig really something. Really. I remember I met him in St. Lucia in this much publicized encounter between him and I. By all America, there were all the ABC, CBS, NBC. They had two crews, one to cover him and one to cover me. And the whole thing that they covered about the OAS meeting in St. Lucia, in the Caribbean country, was this. And I remember well when I first saw him, they came to sit in that great big table where the ministers sit, and it was across from me. He kept trying to intimidate me by eyeing me down, do you say, by giving me this great
eyeballing.
I said, what's wrong with you? Are you nuts? And then I kind of enjoyed me talking with him, but I say he was a bit something. Then you get this Schultz, and that's a pitiful thing because Schultz was not really a member of the inner circle of President Reagan. That doesn't function when you have a foreign minister. It must be the closest person to the, if you're going to have a good foreign policy. And that, fortunately, was my case in Nicaragua. Has always been with Daniel. We're the closest any two people can ever be. But in the time of President Reagan, the real foreign minister for the main international issue of President Reagan was this other madman, Elliot Abrams.
And Oliver North. They were running
they were the ones who,
against your country.
They were the ones who had the access.
Right.
Whenever they wanted to, they could get into Schultz. Schultz didn't have the guts to oppose something that in his heart he knew was wrong. But he also knew how attached, how obsessed, how pathologically obsessed Reagan was.
Right.
To the overthrow of Daniel, of the Sandinistas.
Even though the Sandinistas weren't anywhere near being communists. As a matter of fact, the communists were opposed to the Sandinistas.
The Communist Party.
The Communist Party.
Oh, sure. The Communist Party was opposed all the time.
Uh-huh. Right.
During our struggle against Somoza, and during our government, and now.
Yeah. Right. Can we go back and pick up our story as to what the Sandinistas did when they took power? What was it they tried to accomplish, and what is it they did accomplish?
Well, immediately, any revolution, if it's an authentic revolution, in ours was, at the core of our purpose is the people's power, democratization. And that implies automatically the development of respect for human rights, political, civil, economic, cultural, and social. And we began, our first effort had to do with, we saw all this energy that the combatants against Somoza had, and we said we got to harness that, is that the word?
Right.
We got to take advantage of that energy and change rifles with pencils. And we told them, okay, now we are going to struggle against another enemy. One of the worst is ignorance and illiteracy. And we had that 100,000 army fighting against illiteracy in one of the greatest ever in history campaigns against illiteracy, the alphabetization campaign. We emphasized education very much. We doubled the number of students in our country from 500,000 to 1,000,000. Now things are slowly going back to pre-revolutionary days. But we did manage to double it. Health service for the first time in our history was going beyond the city limits into the rural areas and into the mountains. And this outpost were the prime targets of the Reagan-sponsored Contras. They killed doctors and destroyed the little buildings that we had. And
also killed teachers and destroyed schools. As well.
The same. And the other priority was the democratization of ownership. We had a concentration in the hands of few. We made new owners over the whole period, about 120,000 families who became new owners. Percentage-wise, in our country, that's a large number of people. We brought unionism that was theoretically allowed, but God forbid if you tried to organize the rural workers.
Under
Somoza, it was never possible. We made it possible, and pluralism of political parties. Before that, there could not be more political parties. Under Somoza, in order to the Constitution said you could, but it said you needed to show 30,000 members, and you have to get 30,000. You have to give a list of all these people, and then they would take. Some parties tried it, especially the Christian Democratic Party, and they were told after they presented a year after 2 years that many of these people are dead, and we have not been able to corroborate, and so they never got it. We said all you need to establish a political party is to give us the names of the boards, the directors of the in 9 provinces. So with 45 members theoretically you could have a party, because you have the president and or the chairman and the vice chairman and the treasurer and 2 vocales. That's a board, and then that 5 times 9 is 45. And so we do have too many, I think. But that's natural, and eventually I think it's going to go down to less, I hope.
During your first elections, the American people don't realize it, but the big election which the United States intervened so heavily on, the most recent one, was not the first election. It was in 84, wasn't it? And this was actually the first free and the last free election that Nicaragua has ever had.
And you won a tremendous victory in 1984.
And it was also the most observed election to date of any independent nation. We had observers from all over the world, and they all testified to the fact of how it was carried out.
And there were what? There were 7 or 8 parties that...
7 parties, but the United States, as I was told by... I think I can say it, I'm not a speaker, Jim Wright, recognized to me, speaking with him in his office. He says, Father, we know it. We know that, our government told Cruz not to run. So, and to say that he couldn't run because there weren't conditions to guarantee his safety or the fairness of the election. And so the United States said it wasn't good elections because Arturo was being prevented from running. And by this time, Arturo Cruz himself is speaking around in this country, has confessed to that. It was all a sham, a very typical U.S. government behavior, because I'm sorry to say, but it's so evident that lying and deceit, systematic lying and deceit, are the main tools of U.S. foreign policy. They lied. That's why I worry so much about American democracy. Democracy requires an informed citizenry.
In fact, there's something else very interesting. On the very night of the Nicaraguan election, where there was also an election in the United States about at the same time, it was presented on American television that some Soviet MiGs were being sent down to Nicaragua and that this was a Soviet military threat to Central America. Later it turned out this was a disinformation story. The Sandinistas were in the process of winning a big election victory, a democratic election, and the Reagan administration wanted to cover over this fact and to present a negative image of what was going on in Nicaragua rather than a positive one. So they told this story that was leaked to the television networks, who then presented it as fact. Were you watching the American television when you heard
this
story, and how did you react to this?
It's
a disinformation campaign of a classic sort.
I expect nothing less from this government. But you know, the worst of it all is not only that they are telling the American people that they are concerned that Nicaragua is becoming like a great military power, and the United States is concerned that Nicaragua was going to invade a neighbor, you see, and that because of that, the United States had to send more arms down there to the neighbors. And the fact is not only that the United States was not concerned about that, but they were angry that we did not fall into the traps, into the trap of going and invading, because we had invaded Costa Rica. To what avail? What possible benefit could have accrued to Nicaragua for doing that crazy thing? We would hold it for, 3 hours or 3.5 hours and then have served in a silver platter what they were dying to get, an excuse. Because even if we had done something which under international law we could have done, which is go right after the basis of the enemy, under international, under the right of eminent defense, you could do that, and also had pursuit, but they wanted us to fall into the trap, and what they were angry about and concerned about is that we were not invading. So it was a real diabolical lie, just like when they said that we were getting too close to the Soviets. That wasn't the concern. They wanted us to get closer, because that's why they went trying to put pressure in Europe and in Latin America to cool it with Nicaragua. They wanted to leave us in such a situation that we had no alternative but to turn to those countries that were not permeable to American pressure to give us what we needed to keep living, oil and things like that. And so I tell you, this country is the plague on humanity, and I really pray. I mean, what is the future? We recently met with President Arias and President Ascona, Daniel, and myself, and signatories of the Central American Peace Treaty. I wish you had been there with your camera to tape that meeting. Some social scientists were indeed, in fact, invited to hear the... And it was really interesting. They were really saying why they behaved the way they behaved, what kind of pressures they were under,
right,
how they knew it was bad, but they didn't know what to do because the pressures were huge. And then we were talking about the third day of meetings. We were 3 days. The third day was, what does the future hold? And then when we came to that, the big question was, what will these people be doing? The future depends on us to a great extent. But even if we propose to do the best of things, this government from this country most usually then interferes to frustrate our plans. Look what is happening in Guatemala today. There's hardly a country in the world where you have a worse human rights situation. Who is to blame? Finally, after a long struggle, the Guatemalans under Arbenz were beginning to undertake the necessary steps for the reforms that were long overdue in Guatemala. It was a democratically elected government.
This was 1953,
54? 53, yeah, you have it in that very well-written book, Bitter Fruit,
right,
by Stephen Kinzer.
Right.
And the United States decided to overthrow Arbenz. And they're always doing that. And so we don't have a chance. These enemies, they speak so much about democracy. How can anyone who would not even allow us independence say that they're interested in democracy? Independence by itself does not lead to democracy, but it is indeed an absolute indispensable prerequisite for it.
Can we ask you about the Contra War and George Bush? We've read in the United States in the Rolling Stone in an article called The Dirty Secrets of George Bush that it was Bush himself and not Oliver North who was initially leading the illegal project of arming the Contras, of giving weapons to the Contras to fight the Sandinista government at a time when Congress forbid U.S. arms being used for given to the Contras. And we heard that Bush himself was part of this project to fund the Contras. Did you get those stories in Nicaragua? And what is your sense of the Contra War, of who was leading it and what its purposes were?
Well, we certainly never, ever trusted Bush. We knew who he was, and we know the degree of his commitment. And Reagan, well, to me, he was a clinical case. Mm-hmm. I mean, Reagan was obsessed, but pathologically obsessed. It's insane that he should have dedicated more time to Nicaragua than to any other single international issue.
It is insane, it really is.
No, I think it's, I don't mean any like irrespect for a human being, but I think he should have been, instead of re-elected, he should have been committed. But at any rate, initially, what was the purpose of the Contra War? Initially, when Reagan first put it together, the objective was the military overthrow of the Sandinistas. That's why Tom Enders got into problems and eventually was kicked out, because he was insisting on what here they euphemistically referred to as the two-track diplomacy. They used to call it a carrot and stick. And Reagan says, no carrots, only sticks. But after the Contra, and they really thought it was going to be a quick thing. Remember how they hooked Honduras into going along. Honduras was reluctant, not out of principle, out of fear. They were reluctant to go with the United States in this. And the United States said, look, in 1 month's time, we will have conquered a sizable part of northern Nicaragua with a city. We will have a government there that we will recognize, and our other friends, our other democratic friends, like Paraguay and God knows what else, will give recognition to that government, making it quite legitimate for us.
Noriega.
Yeah. And we will move in and give them support and whatever. But they promised Honduras that at any rate, this would never take more than 3 months. And in 10 years, they never got one inch of one city for one day. So already within the first term of President Reagan, he realized that the Contras were not going to be able to achieve the purpose for which they were created. But he nonetheless chose to maintain it, because the main objective, as Roy Gottman has well documented, and people like Peter Kornbluh from the Central American Archives in Washington, the main objective was the destruction of the Nicaraguan economy.
Yes.
The Contras would help towards that.
Right.
And then you have the Contras and the destruction of the economy, which itself according to this theory, then it would bring the discontent among the people, and the people that would be an uprising, and then maybe you can get the Honduran army in, and God knows what, and then get rid of, do a repeat of what they did in Wiwili in 1934, wipe out the Sandinistas.
I think one reason particularly they were aiming at the economy was not only to create a lot of discontent among the people so that the Sandinistas would lose their support, but also it was very dangerous to the United States, the fact that the Sandinista economy had flourished before the U.S. Right. intervention. It was the had the largest growth rate in the hemisphere.
In the first 2 years of the revolution.
Right.
And that was terrible. A bad example that you were being independent of American economic interests and governing your own economy in the interests of your own people. That's very bad, Miguel.
That's the title of a book from published in England about Nicaragua. The title is Nicaragua, the Threat of a Good Example.
Right. That's correct. Yeah. Can I ask a question about Noriega? That's part of the Contra War. Noriega was working with the Reagan administration to supply the Contras, etc. On the other hand, there were also rumors that Noriega was friendly to Cuba and Nicaragua, that he was playing both sides of the street, so to speak.
Any leader, any government official or head of state, if he's going to be a good asset for the CIA, must play it both ways, must have. He's not going to be efficient if he doesn't have relations.
Right, true.
So that's not surprising. And it is true that Noriega had these relationships. And what is also true is that whatever he did in regards to drugs and that was with the full approval and knowledge of this government, who usually plays the role of the international hooker. just to have a greater possibility of control.
Right.
And Mr. Hooker is in the president of the United States. I may be kicked out for saying that, you know, but so I say that because I believe it. And how do I see the invasion of Panama? It's gross. Unbelievable. It proves what Conor Cruz O'Brien says in his book recently published by Harvard University Press, Godland. He says that the problem is that the United States doesn't feel so much to be the appointed by God to do something. It has reached the point where of the deification of the state. It is itself God, and therefore above any law, human or divine. And so they invade the country, and they do it just to save democracy. And it's sad. But that's why I say at this point in time, and for some time in the past, the United States is behaving as a plague in humanity, as a plague for those who really want freedom, who really want independence, and who really want democracy. Mm-hmm. These people mention these words only to dirty concepts that are very good and deserve to be respected and practiced. And so I hope someday that the American people will wake up and really show me that they love their country more than they love their individual selfish objects, and begin to exert a leavening action within their own country. I remember, as a foreign minister, other foreign ministers sometimes, in a patronizing sort of way, would say to me, you know, Father, what a possible good can come to Nicaragua from this uneven struggle. Why don't you forget about it all? And you know, and then I would answer, what would be the future of the world if there were not countries willing to stand up, regardless of what happened to us? Christ was crucified, and I think those who stand up, Dr. King was killed, Mahatma Gandhi was killed, our country was sentenced to death by the United States because we committed the heresy of saying that we upheld the principle of sovereign and legal equality of all nations, regardless of territorial dimensions or economic or military might. And this, according to this U.S. state religion, is heresy, and we must be burned to death.
With the collapse of the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc of countries, there's no recourse, there's nobody to help any of these smaller countries.
Yeah. And with the abdication of Europe, mm-hmm. Europe has become a great big supermarket.
Because the European countries were helping Nicaragua for a while.
Yeah, but I saw it in the Gulf War. I mean, the Gulf War need not be. And I remember talking to people like President Mitterrand, why not say it? And to Andreotti, and they've gone to Bonn, and gone not only to King Hussein, but to other capitals, and then to Saddam Hussein for a long time. And I realized that there was no need at all for any war. Not that I'm justifying certain actions or the taking over of Kuwait, but there are means for peaceful settlement of controversies. But the United States wanted to expedite that process because they wanted to try out the new Hatari in this country that presents itself as a beacon of uprightness to the world, became involved in an obscene orgy of blood, and the American people rabbled in it, and that's a shame. It was the first pornographic spectacle that you could ever imagine. Sheer pornography, the way the American people rabbled. And they presented the crimes that were being perpetrated as the latest Hatari game, forgetting that behind those dots and behind those lights, whatever you saw there on television, it was real people who died.
Right. Can we talk about a couple more subjects in the time we have left? Can you tell us about the elections which took place, in which the Sandinistas lost, in which the U.S. intervened so heavily? Can you tell us about that process?
We advanced the elections by almost a year. I can share with you that I was initially the one to recommend to President Ortega that we do so. My responsibility was foreign relations, and I said, look, maybe this fellow is different from Bush, from Reagan. Okay. Many times, as a result of my conversations with U.S. senators, we would do certain things in such a way as to enable Reagan to step off and say that he won, claim victory. We would do certain things. It was served for him to say, because the senators will tell me, Father, he needs to save face, so don't make it too hard. Do this thing and do this, that, and do that. Things that we were going to do anyway, that was not in contradiction with our principles, and so we would do it. But I told the senators before, forget it. I'll do it so that you will know something more about your own government and your president, to show you. And eventually they came to tell me, Father, you're right, never again are we going to ask you for a gesture. You were right to begin with. But I said, I told Daniel, I said, maybe this fellow Bush is different. Let's try him out. And then I said, maybe if we have the elections quickly, do not expect that he will even talk to us, even if we say that we're going to advance the elections. He will invite to the Oval Office, I said, whoever is his choice. But I had no clue ever that it was going to be Mrs. Chamorro. But I did guess it that there were going to be picture opportunities as means of pressuring the people and saying, this is my anointed one, this is my chosen one. You choose her and we'll pardon your life. You choose the other one and we'll continue to kill you. That was what happened. And They say there were free elections, and the people went to vote with a gun in their heads. And yet what is amazing is the 41% of the people said, okay, go ahead and kill me. And they voted for that. Under such circumstances, that's a very high.
Because they believed in the Sandinistas and what you had attempted to do for the country.
Yes, now what is happening is, again, is right. Surreal, because the United States put together this coalition called UNO. Unión Nacional Opositora, 14 parties, an unbelievable assortment of the most radical, they call it the Movement for Popular Action, Marxist-Leninist, Communist Party, Socialist Party, and then you move more towards the center and then to the extreme right. And they all together make this UNO. And then they were told how to run a convention in which you elect a candidate with popcorn and all the trimmings of American. And so, and they took it seriously, and they thought they were free to choose their own candidate. And they had the first voting, and Mrs. Chamorro only got 2 votes. You needed at least 8. Someone who represented private enterprise got 6. His name is Bolaños. And then Virgilio Godó, who was the president, vice president, got 6. And then Washington is worried. They sent down an emissary. But anyway, they had a second round of votes. It was a repeat performance. Mrs. Chamorro is about to withdraw to free those 2 so that maybe the stalemate could be resolved. The State Department says, no, Mrs. Chamorro is the candidate. Otherwise, there is no help, economic help, for the elections or after. And so she wasn't really freely chosen. Godoy feels, the man who is the vice president, that the presidency was stolen from him. He is committed to the overthrow of Mrs. Chamorro. The UNO coalition is against her, almost all of them. The real base of support of Mrs. Chamorro is the Frente Sandinista. We want stability, we want... And so it's surreal. And the other people feel betrayed by the United States because they talked about so much money that was going to be given, and they're giving crumbs.
Oh, yeah.
The international team of experts from Oxford, from Harvard, and from the United Nations Economic Commission for Latin America, from ICLA, they established the amount of damage caused by $17 billion. And the World Court said that the United States had to pay for reparations, for damages. And but they pressured Mrs. Chamorro into forgiving the United States. What a shameful thing. And she, with her bourgeois logic, went on television and said, it is not good manners to ask a friend to pay up. So we are forgiving the United States because they are so good. They are so good to her. She feels indebted because she's president. But anyway, we have to put that behind us. We got to see now how, while the United States is looking in another direction, we'll bring the Nicaraguan family together. We work for the interest, not of a party, but of the people. And things are moving, I think, in this direction, although the hardships are great.
Well, also, they've dismantled a lot of the gains made by the Sandinistas, have they not?
Yes, but they threatened to dismantle more. But they haven't made, well, certainly in education, certainly in health.
And land reform. And they're letting the old landowners
No, not really. That has been stopped.
Oh, okay.
And we have had good gains in that area because, for example, they come out with this idea of privatization as if it was something new. We were little by little pushing this for years, and we would have continued. And we said we are not against privatization, or on the contrary, we're for it. But privatization, don't forget that the poor people are also part of the public, who should have an option to buying a part in those enterprises. And we insisted on, at least in the sugar industry, on 25% going to the poor, that they not be redlined and prevented from credit to buy. And we got it. And then the big battle this last few days has been that we didn't want the worst 25% because some of those sugar mills are run down and not good, and then you have others that are very modern and sophisticated and great. And then if they had it their way, the poor, the workers would have gotten the bad ones. No, they got the better ones. Mm. So you do that. The role of the Frente now is to be a kind of a mediator between the people that are every day better organized And the government. And now the government has asked the Frente Sandinista to prepare by June of 92 proposals on how to mitigate the suffering of the poor, which results from the economic adjustment measures, how to more equitably and justly distribute the sacrifice, as it were, of the belt-tightening policies.
So you're fairly hopeful of the future of your country, then?
I am an incorrigible optimist in spite of all the things. I believe in God, and that means I believe in people, and I believe in history, and I believe in our people are valiant. I don't believe that things happen by themselves.
Right.
We got to do it. But I work every day as a community organizer for the empowerment of the people in the slums. And it is there that I get my renewed faith and optimism, in spite of the fact that the suffering is huge and that I cannot ignore the fact that any other country with the same kinds of social pressure, what you would be reading about is looting of supermarkets and bombings and tanks coming out. And I just hope that we are able to lessen that tension, because everything human is limited and finite, even the proverbial patience of the Nicaraguan people.
And that's the end of this Alternative Views. Frequently hear from viewers who request a list of news publications, which we use on Alternative Views, and also a reading list for U.S. power structure in the mass media. If you would like to have these, send a stamped, self-addressed envelope to the Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713. You must send a self-addressed stamped envelope. We would like to thank our crew who helped make the program possible. Kevin L. West was our audio man. Eric Eubank ran the camera. And Chris Kirby assisted in the editing. Alternative Views is a production of the Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713. So that's our address if you'd like to write to us. Goodbye.